Kanzler, Lothar Struder, Nase. Vice-Kanzler Elke Schiffer, Dr. Albert Spanierster. Chief Financial Officer, Mr. Bulelani Batanu. Deputy Vice-Chancellor, Teaching and Learning, Professor Renuka Solifalos. And the Deputy Vice-Chancellor, Law and Management, Professor John Novak-Milvich, and the person of the UAZM Financial Office. I'd also like to welcome the officials from the Department of Higher Education and Training, media, members of the public, and other distinguished guests. On behalf of the committee, I would like to lead this moment and congratulate Dr. Panyasta for his recent appointment as Vice Chancellor and Supervisor of the University of KwaZulu-Natal. We wish you all of the best and God's blessings in your appointment. The purpose of this meeting is mainly for the committee to exercise oversight functions on governance, administration and finances of the university, and to check whether the university has factored in the national plan goals in itself. And also check on the progress made in the transformation of the institution as a government order, but also in terms of the Department of Higher Education training policy, transformation policy. Universities should contribute to the global knowledge economy of a country, generate high-level knowledge and research. We believe that in order to build a prosperous country, all young people must have access to social education and particularly university education. However, there are structural challenges in education across the country, especially in priority skills and critical skills areas, talking about science, engineering, and technology, health and safety. In this case, the critical skills area, there is a relatively low qualification rate, especially by black female students and those who come from the industry. As the council, we need to address this so as to diversify our knowledge base in order to meet the developmental goals of the country. If your researchers at both these gaps and structures are addressed, so graduation numbers are promising in science-based qualification, and the same can be said when it comes to women graduation. We commend you for publishing 1,425 units in 2020, which made you number one in the country. I'm sure we will be around the way of the publishing. Now, we know you've already said this. Or if there's any movement, when your graduation numbers, which I have spoken to that, well, these two with, I really would like to welcome all of you, please, let's make this meeting our meeting and we can say robust to myself, thank you very much. We will then move on to item number two, which is apology.
We received one approach from CDN, who is attending the rules committee meeting today, and we also received an approach from the minister who is attending the committee meeting. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Is the person member of the music?
My name is Denise Banner, the lead of the producer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Callum from the Parliamentary Monitoring Group. Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Thank you, Chair. I'm assuming that the members have been introduced.
Now we're going to item number 4, which is briefing by the Minister of Kwazulu-Natal.
just so you know, if you sent through quite a lot of stuff information, just to be.
Thank you, Chairperson, members of the committee. As UK veterans, we welcome the opportunity to engage with members of the portfolio committee. As a university, we come from a background of a very challenging merger, and for us, what was critical was for us to define an identity for us, for ourselves as a university, and that identity we defined as desiring to be the premier university of African scholarship. And that African scholarship to be underpinned by research leadership, and as the chairperson pointed out, we are at a point of leading research in research output in South Africa. Secondly, excellence and academic excellence, and what is critical there is that excellence in knowledge production and excellence that intersects with the transformation project. So for us it was critical to demonstrate that we can achieve research leadership through ensuring that the baccalaureate produce knowledge. Knowledge that is relevant to our province, knowledge that is relevant to our country, and knowledge that is relevant to Africa. And that knowledge that is created by Africans, such that is also global relevant. For us, one of the important factors in defining our new university was to ensure that the goals of access are achieved. And to ensure that not only Black students and disabled students can access our university, but also that rural students and students who come from needy communities are able to access higher education. So the presentation that will be provided by the Vice Chancellor will demonstrate to the portfolio community an organization that is holding its identity as a relevant knowledge producing institution, as a relevant teaching and learning institution, and as an institution that sees itself contributing to national goals and national services. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Now we'll
thank you, Chair, and again, thank you, honorable members, for providing us this opportunity. I thought the best place to start conversation, what we do have here is quite a lot of information and some dense slides have been distributed to you. So I will skim over some of them and just highlight some certain issues rather than going into all the details, because otherwise it will take a few more time, so we have permission to go through some of those slides already. But I think that we thought it would be useful to start off with a conversation about the transformation charter. Now, as one of the innovators at the University of California, the formulated transformation charter, part of it is a core part of the district, to say that we are committed as an institution to make sure to be the big university of African scholarship, and that this achievement that we set ourselves is dependent on transformation as a process. And when we talk about transformation, of course, we have a much deeper and broader categorization than just basic race and gender. Rechanging the identity and the culture and the importance of perspective, make sure we achieve excellence in everything that we do in the process of transformation, and that the one that doesn't happen at the expense of the other. If you do both, it's essentially the objective of the institution. So our aspirations at the national level, of course, are to yield the students, to provide excellent teaching and learning as far as community engagement is concerned, but also in terms of research. Deliver contextually relevant curricula, recognize the importance and value of African languages, and prioritize the well-being and growth of every individual staff and the institution. And reflect race and gender representation of all management structures in terms of the staff growth part of the human population. This is our aspiration. To be a socially cohesive and inclusive institution, from discrimination of any kind, malicious collegiality, reflecting new and impressive ideas. Okay, just to first of all say that we also recognize our current position where we are. progress in the area, but we still have significant work to achieve to realize that abolition is not possible. Besides that, we commit ourselves to the following principles. So as an institution, we will try and tie our ears to the list with our with that background, the institution therefore decided to formally adopt charter students of the University of Guadalajara in this transformation charter presented to the today. And I'll give you some sense of the highlights of the charter. The charter essentially presents us to the university, a place where research, teaching, learning, and scholarship are a patient for everybody in the institution. Race and gender representation is elements of all structures. The socially cohesive and inclusive institution of health supplies. Good modes of governance are enshrined. The right to freedom of expression is guaranteed. Advancement of the transformation agenda is the responsibility of all. And with that background, that gives you a sense of what we're trying to achieve as far as the is concerned. Gives you a sense of what you're going to achieve as an institution. I don't want to create the impression that we've managed to do all these things. We're comfortable with the space in which we find ourselves. I think there's many areas where we actually have to do significantly more work to achieve the ideal institution. As far as the governance and management of the institution is concerned, first thing I'd like to bring to your attention, of course, as with other institutions, the highest level of corporate governance in the institution carried by the University Council. In other words, we are responsible to ensure that we abide by all principles of good governance and abide by codes of corporate practice and conduct and ethical behavior as indicated in the PQ report, but also in the Higher Education Act. This responsibility of Council is contained in the mandates of the Audit and Risk Committee, where they have to monitor compliance to these codes on an ongoing basis, both the PQ as well as the Higher Education Act. And in the university structure itself, we have functions for internal audit, forensics, as well as risk and compliance, and as well as an active audit of the university. The full contribute to the expected governance across the institution to the best of our ability. So I think we have good governance structures in place to try and intercept the major principles of considered good governance in the South African market. Our council presently has 50 members, independent members, government-appointed representatives, convocation, executive management committees, employee representatives, and student representatives, as per most universities. To give a sense of the size of the council and where the membership emanates from, and of course, as with most councils, there is a significant turnover. On the 30th of June, we lost 7 of our members to take off the council. Some of them, as you see in the bottom, were re-elected back onto council for the second term. And some of them have subsequently, one in particular, our vice chair subsequently resigned again. But I think it gives you a sense that we have a dynamic council with people coming in, people that contribute to the goals of the institution on an ongoing basis. And what's really encouraging is the fact that the real commitment that we receive from our council members in terms of attending our council meetings or contributing because of some of this, the subcommittee activities for the institution. The roles of the chairperson of council are clearly separated from that of the chief executive officer or vice chancellor. The council of the University of KwaZulu-Natal is responsible for the overall strategic direction of the university and also contains a number of members of carrying out Remuneration Committee, Standing Committee, of Finance Committee, of course we have the chair with us today, the Membership Committee, Audit and Risk Committee, as well as the Staff Committee. So this is a standing committee of the Council contributing the sound running of the Senior Appointments Committee, the last one, and then of course all these committees together, all the Council members together with the Staff Committee. As far as our conduct is concerned, we try and make sure the council makes sure that the institution and its staff accountable as far as we get also the council members also each other accountable for the community. Every year, at least once a year, we do commit ourselves to reaffirm the commitment of council to principles of corporate governance through the approvals of the chair of council and the colleges function according to a high degree of autonomy. We define the model, faculty model, in those local institutions. But we think it provides us certain advantages, and we're happy to discuss some of those from the opinions of the community. A little bit about the financial position of the university. The finances of the university are finely balanced at the moment, I think, in terms of what we can do. It takes some very careful work from the CFO and the people in finance to make sure, together with council and oversight provided by finance members, to make sure that we break even at the end of the year as an institution. As a result of the merger, the institution has emerged in a shape where it does carry, if you can look at the balance sheet of the institution, four key components that either come from the merger or have been incurred since then. First of those is the issue of human debt. I think the chair of council indicated that the university has always tried to be accessible to students that come from underprivileged backgrounds. And because of that, we tend to have a high number of students on our campuses that cannot afford to pay students. That does result in unintended consequences, which is student debt, which we as an institution have pursued, and which we have mixed successes in terms of recovery. That's the reality of where we stand at the moment. And more or less to give you a sense, on average, student debt is accumulating at a rate of about $80 million a year, which is really too high for us to sustain and could create significant problems for us as we move ahead. And this is something that the institution needs to come to this room and to deal with, because otherwise it's going to create problems for us. The second item there is post-time and mental aid. The current liability of $1.23 billion stands, of course, comes from the merger and some of the benefits that the employees had from previous institutions that merged with the university. Of course, new people that join the institution don't have this benefit anymore. These are basically older staff of the institutions, particularly in the age of 55 to 69, currently enjoy their benefits and their stand. That's a large chunk of money to just deal with. We are considering a cash offer to reduce liability in the institution, with the understanding that a cash offer means that you actually dig into your cash flow as an institution with that consequence that we have to deal with. So this is a process that has to be dealt with very sensitively, but we believe that unchecked, I think said at the bottom there, that liability is likely to grow to at least 2 billion rand before it starts to plunge into the future. And this liability will be on the institution at least for the next 50 or 60 years until we lose the majority of the current beneficiaries as opposed to not buying them. So buying out some of those members, I think, is something that we ought to consider. We need to do it carefully and not undermine the cash flow of the institution in the process. Depreciation. Of course, we have infrastructure spread across 5 campuses and institution, and we do spend at least 100 million a year to maintain and upgrade the infrastructure that we have. Most of that money comes from the Department of Higher Education and Government infrastructure grants. But the reality is, and I'll show you later, that that level of expenditure does not cover the backlog of maintenance that's accumulating across the institution. This is something that we need to apply our minds. We have an institution trying to increase efficiencies, but even the cost structure, and cut down on staff where we felt we were overstaffed. But one of the interesting things that have emerged out of the merger for us, and one of the most difficult things we're trying to deal with, is to transform the staff ratios in the institution. We have about 3,200 staff members, about only 1,300 of those are parents. So you're sitting with an institution where the vast majority of staff members support the minority by academics, which is essentially the reverse of what you find in many of these universities. So usually it's 60% academic, 50% support staff, they have more than the parents. And this is a challenge for us as an institution that we have to deal with, and we're trying to shift the weight towards academic staff over time in a responsible manner, because we also want to impact on the student staff ratios. So, for us as an institution, of course the government funding has increased below inflation generally over a number of years. So the only way that we can manage our finances is to place significant emphasis on maintaining our cash flow in the institution. These long-term liabilities are things we may or may not be able to deal with, depending on where we find ourselves financially at a particular point. But for us, it's important to make sure that we maintain a positive cash flow in the institution. It's the first step of digging yourself out of the long-term financial order to make sure you have the cash available, you manage your cash flow adequately and responsible. This next slide gives you a summary of what is the revenue of the institution between 13 and 14. And then I just want to add is the extra line between the service technical and marketing that has come out of the slide that we sent to you guys in the next 7 or 6. So we do have a surplus on an annual basis, a small surplus, which is our trying to manage our cash flow in the institution. But we do also have on an annual basis a small deficit of council control funding that we have to manage. Of course, we do get from other sources that allow us to compensate for that partially. But we do have to look at our cash flow very, very carefully in the institution. And this creating problems. One of the things we are going to have to look at as far as cash flow is concerned is to make sure that we look at the student debt issue, because that impacts directly on the cash flow, and we have to think about how we're going to do it. The thinking in the past in the institution was to try and increase the rates of student funding that you require from the visa students. But the problem is you have a large proportion of non-fee paying students, and this is probably by increasing the student fees, all you're doing is increasing the debt for the pupils in the long term because they're not paying anymore. And that's an unintended consequence of that strategy. So are we going to be able to look at increasing deposits in a way that allows to enhance the cash flow of the institution in the short term? It's an unfortunate truth, but this is where we find ourselves. To give you a sense of the balance sheet items, in other words, the restricted funds, the council controlled funds, endowment funds, cash and cash equivalents, and investments across the institution that contribute to the balance sheet at the end of the day. And then we have some borrowings that have been paying off and working off, particularly around the sorry creation of very needy student accommodation facilities at the institution at that stage, and then of course the post-climate liabilities you see at the bottom there, I told you earlier, one of the major liabilities. This is the student debt issue that we have to talk about, and you'll see that the non-recoverable student debt has jumped in the last year from 178 million to 279 million. This impacts on our cash flow tremendously every year. And the auditors have actually been incapable of that. They have to simply write that they get to the done. So managing the cash flow of the students in terms of deposits and so on is something that we have to do better. And we have to be much more vigorous about as an institution to make sure that we bring down this annual write-off that we have and effects on our cash flow as an institution. The focus on research, outputs, and innovation as an institution, we've had to, as mentioned by Jay earlier, to report that we've managed to steadily grow the research output in the institution over time, including a number of publications, post-major through funding awards. Particularly important for us is the broad participation of research by staff across the entire sector. We have more than 80% of our academic staff contributing to our research efforts at the moment, which is much higher than we find in many other institutions, which I think is a positive. Now we focus on the next step, which is to increase the quality of those research outputs, and I think we're working very hard to make sure we get there. An increased number of the doctoral degrees awarded in 2014 by 54% compared to 2013, and the master's degrees by 15% compared to 2014, which is an indication we're producing over 250 PhDs a year in the institution, which is one of the highest PhDs, comparable to the other highest PhD institutions. Our research productivity units has increased by 13%. Increase our funding from the National Research Foundation, nothing to do with tonight, so you there. But the university has also achieved a gold ranking amongst the 2.1% of the world leading academic institutions by the same world university rankings, and put the rank 45th amongst a total of 700 universities according to the from the BRICS ranking from Times Higher Education. And for a chair, I'm happy to say that for the second year running, managed to maintain top universities in South Africa research for the trying to sustain our effort. But of course, having this research potential is wonderful, but it's got to be turned into a long term. And one of the major exercises we're undergoing on the campus at the moment is to make sure that we unlock the massive entrepreneurial potential that is locked up in our research activities. And of course, this also speaks to our goal of becoming a driven university scholarship. The instrument that we put in place to deal with unlocking these entrepreneurial possibilities of us is Incubate. That received seed funding from the Technology Innovation Agency. We launched a number of interesting projects that caught the public eye, and some of them are mentioned there for your interest. But I think for us, what's important is that we need to now build commercial potential that they need to unlock through our research potential. Incubate is focusing on generating spin-off companies and research activities to make sure that the activities we're involved with is not commercial benefits. Of course, some of these have progressed to the point where we're already in the process of developing prototypes and marketing materials around particular insulin. And some of these most interesting ones are the transdermal delivery of insulin, a very tricky process, of course, with insulin, a very large molecule. Do that across the skin surface is not something that is very easy. I think the multi-fitness work in the power line respect and robot is one of the important in the EI over the last couple of years. Because the Impress is a big part of our activity. Every year we maintain the UK as an Impress. We haven't shut it down like many other universities have. And they continue to produce very important works for our society and for our academic community. This is an example, just two slides there, of some of the outputs that we've produced recently from the Gazette and Press. And then particularly noteworthy on the first slide are some of the outputs that have already received accolades from the academic and public communities for the impact of that work and how important it's considered by the board. Now, Gazette and Libraries, we've been focusing over the last few years on increasing our infrastructure access and focusing on the proper management of our recollections at the institution. Also in 2014 we managed to open our computer management library research commons as an area that promotes research activity and allows postgraduate students to engage on an ongoing basis and have access to these resources on an ongoing basis. Of course, the library environment is changing very rapidly at our university, as most universities. Internet-based services that we use are becoming more and more available as a matter of fact, and you will see that the consequence of that is that Waterloo, as with most other libraries, that the steady decline in the use of book collections seems to be an international trend, and it's effective in the way that we use our libraries. So that also means that we have to transform the way we think about libraries and how we use them in the research conference on the university campus. We do have a number of special collections that are noteworthy at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, the Adam Clayton Center and Struggle Archive, the Grundy Physics Documentation Center, the Campbell Collections, and the archives that we've added in themselves. The Adam Clayton Center celebrated its 25th anniversary on the 23rd of April last year, and I think it's important to understand that these special collections are really important in terms of creating the kind of environment and campus that our students can aspire to become great in. Because I think what these special collections do is that they create a climate of students aspiring to emulate the achievements of great people in the past and to perform at their best in the future. As far as student housing is concerned, UKZN houses about 12,000 students on an annual basis, close to 12,000. 10,000 of those on the university accommodation, and a close to 1,000 in private bond accommodation. some of our campuses. We've seen the distribution is standard at the moment. Of course, the university is in the process of trying to enroll new student housing to strengthen the number of students we can accommodate on our campuses. As far as student housing is concerned, we're really concerned about the wellness of our students. We have initiated the residence life program at the university and also increased the off-campus wireless access to students, particularly at the non-university residences, to make sure that all our students in the property get getting access after hours from their residence. But of course, the last up in there, the last one, ongoing concern for us, we have to continue to work on improving the safety and security of our students and staff on our campuses, both at the residences and on the campuses themselves. So this is an ongoing area of investment and continuous improvement. So the next section of the presentation focuses on some of the achievements of the institution, and that contains a long list of indicators that we use to monitor and measure our progress in the institution. I'm not going to share all this information in detail with you, but I'll run through the slides just to give you a sense of what the picture is that they're trying to sketch for us about what's going on compared to them. The common slide just gives you a context for interpreting and understanding the data that I'm going to present to you. So please refer back to that if you're uncertain about where the data come from and where it is. This important figure is that they've come to enrollment in the last 4 years. You see we had actual enrollments and targets, and we've more or less met on average targets over the 4 year period. Some years slightly below, some years slightly above. But there's an infinity of 50,000 students across all our campuses at the moment. That seems to be a good job. More or less stabilizing at the moment, and we'll see where that goes from there. Undergraduate and postgraduate enrollments, it's important to understand that we represent the process of trying to cut down on the proportion of undergrad students and increase the number of postgraduate students. And undergraduates down 74%. So 4/3 of the students more or less on campus are postgraduate. Enrollment by race, African students 69% in 2015, Indian students 24%, and white students 5%. Give you a sense of the racial demographics of our students. Enrollment for African students in particular, the actual is up to close to 30,000 students, and I always remind people this means we have more African students at UKZN than other universities have students on their campuses. Alright. So there's a large chunk of African students that come to this institution. But what's important at the bottom is that it also exceeded our targets for enrollment of African students over the last number of years. Enrollments by gender, large number of female students, that's just simply because females are better students. And I think it's simply something that we find that females are just more studious on campus in general than we find. I don't know why, it just seems to be that way in the university environment. As far as residents are concerned, about a quarter of our students are resident students. In other words, there are a large number of our students, close to 12,000 that we indicated earlier, or maybe up to 1,000 on the basis. Our international postgraduates, around 15-16% of the postgraduate students, I think this is a number we'd like to push up a little bit, but not much, and I think it's something that we want to work on to make sure that we also internationalize our campus. When we talk about a campus, it's not just about protecting South Africa as a demographic campus. University campus should also be a cosmopolitan in nature. In other words, it should protect the broader global society in some sense. Those as bursaries that we allocate, funding has been available, unfortunately, has stagnated a little bit, but the student funding has increased, and you can see as a result of that, we can fund fewer and fewer students over time, but it's up to about 17% of all our enrollments at this stage qualify for this stage funding. I think an important point to make here is that the university adds significant numbers of bursaries and scholarships to this funding that's available, and as an institution, we spend about 700 million rand a year to fund students across the system, using all the resources and opportunities we have available. Pass rates for undergraduate and postgraduates, 8% and 74% on average. The dropout rates, slightly higher for undergraduates, 19%, and 8-12% for the undergraduate students. I think it's also important to just understand here that although the dropout rates are at that level, that are, as an institution, graduating more and more students over time. The number of students graduated on an annual basis has grown from about 8,500 4 years ago to about 10,000 the year before last, and we've dropped down slightly to below 10,000 again last year. But on average, if you look at the institution, we aspire to graduate about 10,000 graduates a year, and that's a significant number. This is the undergraduate doctoral distribution, if you like, of the graduates at a stand for the last 3 years. The graduation rates, about 20%, is that 20% of the institution? Student staff ratio is important here. We have a target of about just under 19% as an institution, and we have just over 21%. And this again reflects that kind of ratio of support staff at the end of staff problems we have to deal with in the institution. Women's academic staff by race, 20% African, 30% Indian, 38% white. I think it's an important point about the transformation agenda at the institution. Clearly, the profile of the academic staff does not reflect the profile of the student population yet. And when I talk about work that needs to be done at the institution, this is precisely the work that needs to be done. Permanent support staff by race, 15% African, 31% Indian, and 10% white. You can highlight there. Permanent academic intern staff by gender, 48% female, male 52%. This is one of the anomalies in life. I don't know whether this is a demographic transition thing. I've never been able to understand why we have a majority of female students in the system and a minority of females in the academic workforce. I think this is something that we have to tackle as a society as a whole. It doesn't seem to make sense. Permanent support staff, 38% female and 42% male. And I think this maybe reflects on that previous conversation as well, in the sense maybe it's about career choices that people make. You know, that they seem to be slightly different in the different genders. And I think this is a, as a society, we need to tackle and address this process. Permanent academic and support staff, give you a sense of the number that I spoke to earlier, is about 40%, just under 40% of our academic third staff is actually academic staff in the institution, which really is the wrong way around. The permanent academic staff with a PhD, we've grown from 47% to 50% as it stands at the moment. And then the last statistic I'm going to show you is the weighted research of permanent academic staff. This has grown from under 2 to 2.37 over the last 3 years, again reflecting the high research output of the institution overall. And we hope to continue that trend in the future. The last major item on that I want to share with the committee today talks about the accreditation infrastructure. We have 5 campuses that contain 540 buildings, with a total replacement value of 10.3%. That shows you the distribution of those buildings across the different campuses of the UKSM. And of course, all these buildings are starting to age. Except for the new ones, the majority are starting to age. You'll see that in the next table, when you see the A category on the left-hand side, the building, the number of buildings associated there. Of course, we've done a lot of new things and added new buildings over the last couple of years, which creates exciting research environments and research opportunities and so on. But we still have to maintain the old infrastructure and make sure that it's viable into the future, and that we can make sure that all that infrastructure is used for the purposes intended. So we have a look at the infrastructure planning and development process. There's a prioritized number of projects over a period of 3 years from 2016. The first of those is that we need to develop a comprehensive master plan for each of our campuses. Spatial master plan, if you like. What goes where, what do we want to do where, what are the opportunities that we're going to unlock, and what are the necessary maintenance and other activities that we have to put in place to ensure that they move forward. These are priority projects that have been identified. Of course, the Department of Higher Education and Training is well aware of the backlog as far as maintenance is concerned, and that's why this year they put out a call for institutions to prioritize a number of maintenance projects in our submission to them. These are the priority projects that are prioritized by UKZN in their submission to the Department of Higher Education and Training to try and pull out some of the backlog here across our campuses. And it was submitted for to the DHT for the 2016 cycle of allocation. I think just to give you a sense of what it requires to look at our maintenance into the future, way beyond the next 2 or 3 years. In the next 3 years, our total maintenance requirements is an order of $2 million, and over the next 9 years it will add up to $1.27 billion across the institution. And again, we have a distribution across our campuses, and then of course the additional cost that we haven't factored in there is the access to disabled people to all our buildings. Just upgrading them to the point, particularly the old buildings, getting to the point where disabled people can have free access to all our facilities is going to require an investment of over $60 million rand to get them all up to speed. If anybody wants details, these are the projects completely considered in that regard, let's make up that $62 million investment. So I think this gives you a sense of the distribution of the backlog in terms of maintenance over the longer period for the university. As an institution, we simply don't have these kinds of resources, and I also understand that the department is strained in terms of providing some of these resources. But I think if there comes a stage where we need to try and forge a better balance between the long-term maintenance requirements and the initiation of new projects on the campuses, because I think, and that's a conversation that needs to happen between universities and the department about what particular requirements are. And I think in the future, a better balance between launching new projects and making sure that we spend sufficient resources on maintenance will achieve a better outcome than what we presently have. We have our replacement value, backlog values indicated in graphs just for information and also how they're distributed across our different campuses. And we've launched the process of integrated facility planning, development and maintenance at the university as a whole. We've used Westbrook campus as a pilot. Just as a matter of interest, we came to our attention that the Westbrook campus is never been consolidated in terms of a single property. At the moment, I think there's 114 properties that constitute the whole of the Westbrook campus, and each one of those properties are charged at different rates by the local municipalities, some are business rates, some are other rates and so on. So we need to consolidate that whole process to make sure that we clean up the whole administration of our state as a whole. Of course, we have to go through other four campuses and make sure we deal with those issues. And then, of course, the land rationalization I've just spoken about, and that's what we're trying to achieve in that regard. This whole master planning process is a comprehensive process that has been carried out in some of our other campuses around the country or other universities around the country. And we're rolling this out over the next 2 years, as you see here. It contains a target of outputs. But the whole process, the whole series of activities that we have to manage over the next 2.5 years to make sure that we achieve the outputs that we put on the table. And then I think what we will have is a thorough understanding of what we as an institution have to achieve to manage a total estate comprehensively into the future. And we hope we can achieve that soon. Madam Chair, I think with that I'd like to conclude and say thank you, Sir Bonga, for your time, and we're happy to answer any questions that the committee may have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the professional and insightful PCE. Who wants to announce that we have joined by the Deputy Minister for the Department of Higher Education and Training? Thank you very much. I must say that honorable members, we have an insightful meeting. I will now open the meeting for reflection and my in that order.
Thank you very much, Dr. Panyako, for an outstanding presentation. And it did reassure me that the university is in good hands after what seems to have been a period of 10 years of hard work and management. What I understand happened was that an authoritarian culture emerged in the university. Many leading academics were either thrown out of the university or left, and it's not going to be fair. We know from this community, many of those who arrived and happy about what's happening at this building. And the name of the university did become tarnished, both here and internationally. And in fact, this was exposed by the Council for Higher Education, ACCP, report, which was convened by the Chancellor. Great. So it's very reassuring to see that your transformation targets the same values such as collegiality, human rights, and other issues which seem are essential to the functioning of the university. But can you just tell us a little bit more about repairing the damage done to the KZN over the past 3 years, and what positive steps you will be taking in order to do that? My second question is about money. Now, it seems to have been made a limitation on the issue of a social debt, which the university is supposed to have had. He got a figure of $1.8 billion. And after about 4 parliamentary questions back and forth, that is still not clear what the actual factors are. The debt that seems by UK's energy framed by the, mainly by the retirement medical aid possibility, which most other institutions in the UK put out of these 10 years, and it does seem that UK's energy is behind the curve on that, and therefore that deficit has grown exponentially. But is there another deficit that we are not hearing about? Was there a loan from the Development Bank about which there are rules? And if so, could you tell us a little bit more about that loan, when it was taken, what the terms, the debt definition of minister, or was there no such loan and this whole thing simply a small piece? If you could just clarify that, that would be great. So I just third commend you on your emphasis on the boring subject of infrastructure. Because it seems that education does have to take place in places, in buildings. People have to live in living. And yet, this is a financially very underestimated part of the investment on that. And I very much appreciate that. Thank you, first of all. Probably everybody wants to say thanks to the team. And members of the building, and how old they are, and what's so very, very
very interesting. That's why we need to ask us to, to push our economy in the country. So thank you very much. And we then have next coming in, the Q&A.
Chairman, thank you for the opportunity. And then we also welcome the access to education and the university community is working toward the realization of that goal. But also to say that the FMAC of the university is going to have to be expanded in these sectors, we don't want to like the protocol that they have underachieved on its enrollment targets. As one could see an extra explanation as what we challenges for proposal and also from the presentation we noted that the university has more sort of staff than academic staff, and therefore the university will not achieve quality totally in the area and the target of 92.1. What is the impact that we have on the quality of the children in Turkey? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Member
Chairman.
Next one is Honourable Member Cabinet.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me first start by welcoming your presentation. And my question is, in 2013, the university had the over-enrollment, which exceeded about 1,722 students. I just want to know how did this impacted on the results of the university, in particular on academic staff and the NSF. And what mechanisms are there in place to make sure that the industry remaining team is approved annual target? The current financial foundation of the students, we know it's 64,000. Now, I just want to know whether the university is still using top-flight and policy when allocating funds to students. And if that is the case, how does the university allocate the students? And the student housing. The university has only 27% of the students in the residence and planning to construct 1,000 base residents. Some of the students in this 27% are staying in their base residence, and then what is the difference in the accommodation fee between the base residents and the university residents? Thank you, Chairperson.
position of giving them certain knowledge, advantaging them rather than just generalizing. But in Morocco, we have a problem where there is no let up and entrance, but we find that it's humanity down the way and mainly humanity. And I would like to indicate that I've heard a great deal of appreciation for your work because I'm still in the Kinemani University Catholic for some time. But I would like to indicate to the position of social. I think you are too new in that university to be rewarded with first well-wishes. Your predecessor and your previous have worked very hard. And I must say, as a galvanized myself, with all the newspapers that I was reading in your environment, the evidence of being discouraged and concerted effort to deal with your council and to deal with your vice chancellor, I do not know where it is. In particular, your medical school was completely under attack on the citation criteria that they do not even agree enough. So each time you recruited and admitted African young women, it seems that you are attracting them in your recruitment. And people must understand that all this came out of a threat. There was a political threat. So I really appreciate the fact that things are coming together, but there has been, you know, the history of the thing. I would also like to caution you on your issues to increase the use of the basis of the death of the institution. You are not a group. In fact, out of the 25 and so odd universities, there is significant debt accumulated as a result of many years of underfunding on student finance. So I don't think the articulation that this has to be dealt with in a manner that suggests that it should be either at the level of entry for integration or integration applied. So solutions have been proven, but they are actually not the best solutions for a conducted environment. Because even when you handle them, you may find that the intended consequence wanted to retrieve more money and achieve the good deal that you did is now hurting you on having your black African afford, not able to afford the apparatus. There's a difference between a professional student, not a professional student, a student that comes from a professional environment whose parents can afford fees, but who not ordinarily have the apparatus, both as tuition and accommodation. But remember, you demand two, you do not demand one apparatus. So you find that the majority of young that come from less African professionals, they will actually decide that at a high tuition question and upfront and your high accommodation question and upfront. And generally also, these fees, I always tell the chef, the deficit is our conversion. We have not scientifically proven that these are correct fees for a South African environment. All of you guys are just charging as you wish. Some of you can't even tell us what is the content of these money, where are they going, what do they do, why so hard? You have not explained that to us. And yet, you keep on wanting more. The environment in South Africa currently requires that we adjust to a specific fee that supports our standardization of the basic, what I would call the ingredients that go to our higher education. We have not done that. Which means there could be a possibility that you are overcharging. And if I just because you for the colonial government is not actually in cash on you. There are, for example, Umalama University, new and fresh, boom, 62,000. For what? They only have debt. So my quest is, you do research. Where do they? Please establish the best class to higher education for them. And then present it to the ministry and say, what the probability of A to C? These are the equivalent that our government can hold. in amount. Right now, it says that anyone who feels that he has to be a greedy or a wicked man is all driven by a certain assumption rather than the basic amount that has to be paid. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. The first one would really want to express the appreciation of your performance at Professional Retirement Commission. I mean, this university traditionally for a very long time was the only university, liberal university that's black. So when you see blacks also achieving other faculties in the university, you become very liberal. That transformatory history is continuing. I mean, guys like people who training as doctors, our own minister here, I mean, blacks were training the as doctors as early as in the 60s. So that tradition, you know, if it continues, that makes us even more happier. My point is number one on infrastructure. We want to get a report that said several countries, in order to solve this thing of spending money in matters that are indirectly academic, like the residents, they are moving education. When you see that from a man, we say it's the government building on classes, residences, and the like. I just want to check now that you're going to strike it with balancing how much you spend on your core business and supporting material. I just want to check rather the possibility. I see instead of the 12,000 students that are living on rest, and while your student population is 44,000, which means already more students are living out of resident. So the electronic education is the possibility where people can use computers to learn and get lectures from computers. That's the first one. That will save us from infrastructure. The second point, which is my most important, is the one when you spoke about unlocking and entrepreneurial potential that is the research. You are starting to see this research money that you have, PhDs, but ultimately what will be meaningful for our society is if these things can ultimately have a direct impact on our society. I mean, if you live in first world countries that generate electricity from base with electricity, alternative electricity, and we have here so much with supply generation of electricity, and yet we don't see a bigger striking of our young senators is trying solar system. But you'd like to see one way the investors can do the cheaper of generating electricity, clean electricity, and it comes from our research. And investors can come into this and invest. So I just want to know how can we really arrest it? Even water, the shortage of water, but we have a lot of underground water, which has been polluted by mining minerals. So I just want to know really how much can we help the economy grow and create jobs just through research, which is just not ending up at universities and books and libraries, but we can see people making a living out of that. Because I would imagine this is how the first world is developing. There's a lot of research, but they benefit, sell, and break and eat food out of their research. I know they are spending more than us, but the little that we already spend in research, really, if it can have a direct impact on our society, that will be highly. So that unlocking of entrepreneurial potential is very important for us to create jobs and how we move forward. The the other point, no, let me rather come back to the other mistake because this one gets me to step up.
Okay, thank you so much for all your questions, comments, and very constructive comments for the University as well as the questions that provide support to all the community. And have your team is one of the things that we have to do.
Thank you, Jay. I think I'd like to follow that question to successful because I think many questions touch on different parts of the portfolio of people that are sitting here. So I'm going to ask them to respond to those questions if they feel comfortable with. If there's any less at the end, I'll come back and deal with it. That's acceptable. So maybe I'll start off with the chair of council. Go down the road. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to address two questions. One references a question from the Honourable Bully, and the other one just touches on a question raised by the Honourable. The first one is a question from Honourable Bully, referring to the fact that there has been damage done to the reputation of UKNM over the past 10 years. We have a contrary view. Our view is that UKNM has achieved remarkably in a very difficult merger environment. We are a product of the merger of two institutions that were previously strong institutions in UK Berlin, and merger rules require strong counsel and strong management. In fact, I have served on the University Council for over 10 years, and I served on the Antwerp University System. And this new university is significantly better than both its ancestors. We cannot talk of damage when, during the last administration that we are referencing, we were able to achieve research leadership. We were able to achieve access. We were able to achieve the transformation results that we have. We were able to build two significant centers of excellence in the form of CARA and CAPRISA, which both were pilots internationally. We were able to have CDU as a compulsory module in the institution. There are many other achievements that I can quote that we have been able to achieve at UK Berlin. Yes, as a result of the merger, we do have surplus staff because the contract of merger was such that we could not lose any people. As a result, if you look at, we then inherited all the staff of our ancestor institution and all the staff that came from the ancestor institution had to be kept, and we have been embarked on a project of migrating many of our support staff into academic staff. And this is a process that has taken some years, and there are some challenges that lay ahead in that respect. The transformation charter that Dr. Hernandez spoke about is a transformation charter that was adopted by the university in 2012 during the previous administration. It was the product of a very long consultation with various stakeholders of the university regarding what represented transformation and what were the key elements of the transformational environment of the university. So it should have been for us. We have worked very hard as a leadership of this institution to ensure that in spite of the challenges of one, student access, to ensuring that most students can thrive in our university, not just black students, but certainly black students from Durban North, but black students from Mbumburu and black students from Mbume can come and thrive in our university. And as a result, as the Vice Chancellor indicated, we do have challenges in that state. Therefore, I would just like to say that any achievement that can be attributed to UKBN over the past 10 years, which is really the age of the institution, is attributable to the university community in which stakeholder governance is well and alive. For us, if you talk about cooperative governance as understood in the legislative framework, come to UKBN and you will see it. The second question that Honourable Martin spoke about was the fact that he believed that the university environment was under attack. Yes, it was, because during the merger, we cannot deny the fact that there were people who were not comfortable with the merger environment. And yes, we would have lost surplus staff. That was a natural consequence of a merger, that because we've got surplus staff, people will go to other institutions. And we actually are supportive of that, because we believe that if we lose a certain threshold of staff, which we consider to be healthy, because it allows us to bring in an African professoriate. It allows us to bring in a young professoriate that we can train, because we know that it does take quite some time to train the people to this. So for us, we manage our turnover levels, monitor it to the council, quarterly and at the end of the year. And for us, below a certain threshold, we believe that that's a healthy turnover that will allow us to bring in young women, to bring in black people to become academics in our institution. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'll just throw two finance questions that are raised by the organization. And that was the deficit. We don't have a deficit of $1.3 billion. If you look at our balance sheet, the deficit is $1.1. And you are right, the large part of the deficit is in the TV, post and handy medical fund. As you know, medical fund, the post and child medical fund is valued in India on a 2-year basis. And once the 2-year say it's a higher figure, that figure is put to the books. When we speak about the school district 2 billion, all these things are achieving calculations, but they go through our books. So, in the last fellowship, we have 1.2 billion. So, those figures are book figures, book entries, really, not really some physical deficit. It could, like we have the other year, as the deficit of 5 or 10 billion, it's not immediate, it's over a period. That's the same in the family middle. Second question on development bank. Yes, we have a lot on the development bank. On page 24 of the slide, you see borrowings there, and these borrowings approximately 600 million. The other development bank, we have two loans on it, and we also have a loan from RMB to us for one of the residents. And that's about 200 million. I think the CFO will put on that. So you have external loan only to the development bank and RMB.
Take some of the questions related to the students in London, but maybe I just want to make one short response, which maybe Professor Mobandiru will extend on, which is to just for the record correct the information that UKZN did not suppress the CFT audit report. UKZN does not have a CAT or an official CAT audit report. So just to make that statement, therefore it did not suppress any report. And I'm sure Professor Mwangizi will expand further on that. Maybe just on in terms, I want to respond to the question on the underachievement of targets in 2015. So UKZN has had an initial dip in enrollment during the key part of the merger in between 2005 and 2007. We did experience a dip in enrollment, especially during the time that the faculties were being moved, all the humanities was moved onto one campus, onto Harvard College, all the science was moved to Westville and so on. But from 2008, it has met from 2008 to now, it has continued to increase in enrollment, and it has met the DHET approved target. DHET allows the institution to be within 2% of the target, and as you can see, we have met and achieved those targets. The 2015 targets, as was noted at the beginning of the presentation, are provisional. So we haven't hit the 2015 targets, which have a lower number, are not the final figures. So if you look at all the other years, the targets have increased. The other point maybe to emphasize is that UKZN in the enrollment plan that DHET has approved has carefully maintained its undergraduate enrollment, but is increasing its postgraduate enrollment. And it has done so gradually over time. And so the question on how is it managing over-enrollment, our over-enrollments are not significant because they're within a 2% margin. And I also want to say that where we are increasing enrollment is in the postgraduate, and that we are managing the staffing of that because postgraduate students who do master's, PhD, require staff with PhDs. So at the moment, the university also has a major project where all staff are being supported who don't have their PhDs are being supported to achieve their PhDs. There are more than 300 academics currently educated and obtaining their PhD. On the issue of the residents, maybe just to make one point, is that the 12,000 in residents as a percentage of our enrollment, which is at 25%, is amongst the highest in the country. In fact, we benchmark that against other institutions. The percentage of their enrollment is much lower than that. Only Rhodes has a higher figure of almost 50% because of where it's located. But UKZN, the figure of that you saw, is amongst the highest. So we house more students as a proportion of our enrollment than most other universities. On the admission policy, on the NCB and CJ qualifications, at the moment we do not have it in our institutional admission policy, but we do have a selection of programs that specifically enroll students from the colleges, and we are at the moment in discussion about how to support the upgrade of the staffing in the TVET colleges. So we're looking at as a research institution that's driving postgrad student production, how do we support staff in the colleges to be better qualified to deliver the programs better. But in terms of admission into our undergraduate program, that is still very much a work in progress that we need to work on further. And then the final point I'll respond to is on the issue of infrastructure and technology. So just to say, as a university, we are all our campuses are wireless, and we are advancing much more use of online facilities by our students. So, for example, from next year, we are rolling out that our students will need to either have a laptop or acquire one for first year students that are entering the university, as well as this year's first year will be second year students next year, because all the course materials will be provided online. We already know that more than 50% of our students, in fact, already have laptops. So, and we have made provision to assist those who do not. So certainly the university is looking at how to support students much more into the future. One last point I should mention, just going back to the admission. The university also 2 years ago, specifically the Senate took the decision that the different colleges would all enroll between 10 to 15% of students from profile 1 and 2 schools. As you know, those would be the poorest students coming from the rural schools and from poor schools, and so we do make specific provisions for disadvantaged students coming from the poorest schools into the university. The college breakdowns. So the college breakdowns, it is the case that the largest number of students are in the humanities, up to 17,000 students. The second largest group is in law and management studies. Maybe Professor Mohanjiju will speak a bit more to that question. Health sciences is the smallest in the region of 4,000 to 5,000. It is also the case that the students in humanities have the largest proportion of African students, but that is rapidly changing across the university. Given that close to 70% of our overall student enrollment is African, it means that African students are increasingly represented across the different colleges. And also in terms of graduation, the numbers of African students are increasing. One of the ways we are specifically focusing on this is that we have a very well-established academic monitoring and support system. The moment a student is at risk, identified on the system as being at risk based on the number of modules he or she passes, they are immediately required to attend mandatory support, in which they are supported to identify what the problem was and then assisted in that. This has resulted in our dropout rate, our graduation rate, throughput rate, is well above the national averages. So, for example, one figure, 30 students dropout rate is more than 20% nationally. Ours is at about 10%. So our figure, we are working very hard, and we really pay attention to assisting students to pass. And so this has enabled us to see better graduation and throughput rates across the system.
Chair, we're back to the issue of the proposed 1.8 versus another chair has passed on this. And then the loans and partly the issue of the student fees. I must say that when I went back to meet our audit for team official courses, my constructive balance was done by the auditors. I understood why somebody could have come to the conclusion that we are saying that the university has got a deficit of 1.8 billion. And just taking out an accountant. And for the first time, this note was put together last week. Auditor General done this sort of thing. But I think that is just a good time to find a way of how to explain the manner that they do. I think the key issue to emphasize is that instead of the report heading along the lines of over time there is operating expenditure of 1.4 billion is of which can be supported by assets, it's very way back to the third section of the activities. I tried as my first chair to get the auditors to issue out a statement to say, indeed, we're looking at this for closing, it subjects to interpretation and incorrect interpretation, and it will succeed. But I just want to confirm my chair for sure. So that the deficit there has been particularly manifested in these deficits. And it is true that a major part of that has been from post-retirement medical aid. And simply post-retirement medical aid is like a loan for the education people with constructing assets or building assets aside to support that loan. Because the tight cash situation and the budget is not being able to do that. And hence now the approach is maybe one hand in that one. Rather, the approach on the budget and see if we can get over and cash. There's been no better than that in this thing. I think the university is going to take. But here, I think we really have this. And once you reach 1.2 billion, you are going to eliminate that fear. The best you can hope for is that it doesn't peak at 2 billion. It peaks at, say, 1.5 to 1.6 billion. And it's too huge now. The low TBSA, there's good chances of that. The first one was around 2006 or 7, long before my time. And the ground that tended to there was infrastructure that was put together as a consequence of the increase of the nature. Part of it was funded by the university, and the other part was funded by the university. Then there was a second change, and we had a lot to do with expansion rather than just increase of nature. So amongst other structures which normally they find it is the center of excellence that it was the investment really where we had a co-founder. And let us just say that the main issue the second time around was in fact they had a 1 billion capital expenditure plan. And the idea this time was that if you use a loan, you have to be prudent. Use it in a prudent way to show that the return is successful by using the loan.
So of the 1 billion rand capital expenditure that was planned, about 350 million rand is coming from TDSA. But partly, I think we were concerned that we can have over the village. We need to understand the 260 of that. 100 million rand, we didn't say. And then understand that after the TDSA is a must now. The issue of student fees will always be complicated. 3 years back, we did just a high-level research when we compared the fees that we charged to four so-called research institutes, universities, and I think two or three comprehensive universities. But even when this, you know, we wanted to compare like with life, but we also wanted to capture the issue of the demographics of the students. So UK was part of the experience. Our assessment was that, as I was talking 2-3 years back, was that we were charging 20% less than the other 4 big universities. We were probably on par with the other, you know, universities in some way. And the decision was taken that we needed to up the fees. And the argument was that we are offering the people that to pay. And we're not aspiring to be paid for this. So that's why we never saw this as an opportunity to raise the gap of 50%. As I recall, I think this was a good success for me. We have actually used the issue of CPTs as well to publicize this work. I mean, that's what the students do as well. So, the community is going to have to, it is just different. And to some extent, the CPTs is impossible so that you can promote students to a level. On average, for students who are aggrieved in looking at the fee of about 23,000 to 24,000
a year.
And for those who are looking at the fee of about 18,000 to 24,000 a year. What did you say? I'm not sure I was a little taken aback by the comments said by Honorable Zoli about the previous leadership of the university. I think she used words like process management, past service, professional support, damage, repair damage, and so on. Most of the comments that I've made about that have been made by our chair of council, looking at the context and content. But I think I'm also grateful to Honorable Mbasha, who, in his comments, talked about the recognition of the previous leadership, the hard work that they have done, and the concerted efforts to bring this what they have achieved. And I think that comment was supplemented by a colleague, the Honorable, across the floor, when he talks about the application of performance on management and transformation for the University of KwaZulu-Natal. I think the record of transformation of the university is a public knowledge. You don't need to really throw out something over us as a person knows how much we've done in terms of transformation. But just to give you one short example, we were just looking at the figure this morning. We have at least 25 professors who are black South Africans, both the associate and the professor of Africa, South Africa. If you give me those numbers, many of the university, I will be surprised, any other university. So that's just one example. I think there was also an issue raised in terms of the 15 reports of the audit that was done, I think, more than 5 or 6 years ago. And I'm also a little surprised that, as we are talking about the process that was reported and intended more than 5 or 6 years ago, other university and I'm sure, we do microphone under the bridge, and you really have come. And what as my colleague said here, as far as we know, there is no report. If you ask for a self-evaluation report, which is submitted to the audit, we will give you one. But we don't have a report, because there was no report. I don't know whether the report anyway, that we never participated in the formulation of the report, which is a normal process. So we don't have the report. If you are looking for a report, we don't find it at UKV. And again, there was also a comment about money, and I think Honorable Gonzalez was very kind to say that it was just a rumor. I think I would be careful to respond to comments just a rumor. I don't know whether the government officer has responded to that. There was a question about our admission policy, and I think that was a very interesting question. I think we've made a lot of song and dance about our access policy, how much we try to get students from different subjects, different backgrounds, from rural areas and so on. So because of that, our transformation policy is really comprehensive and friendly for access. So although we have strict and well-defined minimum requirements, but we also have policies through which we admit students that have all kinds of qualifications, and this is what we call the recognition prior learning process. So without any details, and it's a very important issue and policy to college, but there is that process in terms of our admission policy. I was also quite interested in the comments made by Honorable Ambassador about the enrollment speed by college, by race, by gender, and so on. This is a very important question. And I think probably we have not done enough to explain to the world the college model that we operate. We are the only university that operates a college model, apart from this, of course, but we are the only contact university that operates a college model. And this is a unique model, where our popular disciplines are allocated to colleges that have same autonomous management and governance, that work toward the same vision and mission of the university. So we think every college is important. We think all disciplines are important, but we also acknowledge and recognize that there are some disciplines that lend themselves more to the national, economic, and social development imperatives. And I think our enrollment policy is designed in that particular way. But we would hesitate to say some disciplines are more or less important than others. I am aware, for example, that our current Minister of Education and Training is very passionate about the humanities. There are so many things to revive what he calls the humanities. And therefore, while we acknowledge that some disciplines are very important for human development, but we also think that such certain disciplines have the role they play in society, and our enrollment policy, our enrollment plan is formulated in that particular way. I think that is all I was going to say. Yeah, there was also a question, of course, about how the enrollment has impacted on the process in terms of when we see the enrollment target. Obviously, over the last few years, we have not exceeded the enrollment target too much. I think last year we went to 104%. It is very difficult to target 100%. Either you fall short a little or you go above a little, but all of those would have slight impact on the allocation of resources. But I don't think we have exceeded our enrollment target in the recent past so highly that our allocation of resources would be seriously impacted. I think I'll stop there and thank you very much.
I just want to maybe quickly on the student funding, just to give some information about the overall funding that we provide. So if we include the network funding, the money the university raises, all our trust funds, and so on, then in 2014, I can tell you that we provided a loan to a value of 270 million to just 5,500 students. award. We provided bursaries to the value of 376 million to about just under 10,000 awards, and scholarships to the value of 108 million to about 5,000 awards. And that, so in the last 2 years, in fact, even in 2014 and in 2013, the total amount of student funding the university has made available to students is in excess of 750 million, and that's about close to 20,000 awards. If you just want to get a comprehensive picture of the extent to which we fund students and seek funding from donors and trust funds, etc., that gives you an idea of the extent of student funding private.
There was a question about do we toss lives money from universities. We do not. What we can say though is that this year I think in a desperate effort to take students here, because I think that's the challenge we've been having. Our students move past all the modules, and because we don't have sufficient cash, we find that some of them actually have to go back home. So this year a decision was taken to fund 70% of their fees, so it's a form of the cost side, and the other 30% will be low. So it's not top slashing, but it just illustrates the point that you couldn't find a whole 100%.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Just a few things that I'd like to pick up that I think people have asked, that I think we owe them more comprehensive information about. The first is the issue of the race, gender profile for college recruitment. We don't have the statistics with us, but we will provide them to you. Can you send those through and make sure that people get hold of that, please? And the second question, that is a clear question, where we don't have the statistics with us, is the PhDs that you asked about, African versus non-South African versus the rest of African in terms of the ratios. We will send that information through to you so that you can see that as well, because we don't have that figure with us at the moment. Just in terms of the questions, I think we've covered most of the ground. Two issues around the cost of education, I think the Honourable Miller raised that earlier. I do think that's a very worthy national project for us to engage with and get a sense of what the true cost of education ought to be. It's going to be rather complicated, but I think we owe it to ourselves to get a true sense of what it really costs to study in Cape Town versus in Delta for our things to use. And I think also what does it really cost us to train an engineer versus somebody in the humanities at the end of the day. I think that those, and I want to put on the table as well, not just those broad categories, because within the humanities, we know the most expensive discipline is probably music, because it's one-to-one teaching. And so, the cost of training musicians is much higher than the cost of training engineers, so we need to understand that there are all sorts of nuances. And of course, the makeup of the training provided by different kinds of institutions is also going to affect it. So, but I think that's a very worthy national project that we would like to participate in and see if we can contribute to that at the end of the day. I wanted to just emphasize, first of all, that I think as an institution, we remain committed to provide access to students that come from a underprivileged background. Unfortunately, we at the tertiary education sector don't have a safety net. And there is no bailout by some of the other institutions in government to see. So we have to manage our finances, and we have to make sure that we try and deal with it in a responsible manner as best we possibly can. But I think that the way forward is for us not to walk away from our commitment, because I think that would be the worst thing for particularly UK universities, because we're not that kind of institution where we use fees to exclude people as a primary mechanism. But I think in terms of balancing our books, are we getting to a point where we have to ask ourselves what kind of contribution can we make to supporting children from underprivileged backgrounds? The funding that contribution explicitly to say this is what we can do and this is how we're going to take it into the future, unless the financial circumstances change. But I think it's a very, very difficult conversation and a very difficult solution to that particular space. I want to just touch on one thing that the Honourable Member raised about entrepreneurial activity and that sort of work. Let me just say from UK to end, we committed and we have really well established programs in areas and fuels of energy, water, agriculture, forestry, all those areas that speak directly to
driving many, much of the entrepreneurial activity is going on. I want to just share a bit of information with the honourable members about job creation and entrepreneurial activities. You know, the reality is the guy that's first invented the TV can create any jobs. The guys that created the jobs are the guys that took that technology and made it cheap enough for you to sell thousands of TVs at the end of the day. Those are the guys that created the jobs. And the same goes with high-end technology. So you need a high-end technology, new inventions, other stuff to happen in the landscape. But it's the people that take those inventions and make it cheap enough so that you can have a big market and put them into the market at a competitive price that really creates jobs at the end of the day. So I think that's sort of the process called disruption and the fuel of innovation. People that take a technology and disrupt it by virtue of bringing down the cost. Then people that they drive jobs. And I think as an economy, we have to really be focusing. If you want a good example of where this happened, look at South Korea. By taking the best TVs in the world, producing them at a lot of price, putting them out in the market. That is a disruptive effect. And I think this is what we should be focusing on in terms of job creation. We want both. We want the people that develop the technologies so that we can disrupt them and put them in the market. And this is what we do by the advantage of the people. Thank you. I think we've covered everything, unless anything you'd like to add.
Thank you very much for, and thank you to all of the guests for their attempts at answering the question. I actually think that this session has proved that this was not enough. That there actually is money owed by this university, which is enormous. I mean, if you think about it, your income, $3.7 billion per year, you also got a loan of what? You may have paid some of it off, but originally 800 million. That's nearly 1 billion. You then have a 350 million rand deficit. You have, you're paying out 700 million and another billion a year to students in grants and bursaries and scholarships. Your number of fee paying students has gone down dramatically, which is the downside of transformation. That it does mean that you're Yes, and unfortunately, when you reduce the number of impacts, you increase the financial instability of the institution. And you have the cash flow problems. So it doesn't look to me as though this is a hugely financially healthy institution at all. And then in fact, the Auditor General may have been perfectly correct in putting that very harsh statement in of the 1.8 billion rand, just to make everybody sit up and take notes, which I think so I do think that there is a real point here that does need to be looked at, and I would like to urge the university to seriously account for what the Vice Chancellor said, that you are taking it very seriously, but the transformation of the kind of debt that you've undertaken comes at a cost. And we have seen that when the University of Fort Hare and other universities have come to present here, and virtually all their students are anticipating. These institutions are now economically unviable. They are actually not viable institutions. So the economy of the university does strike me as something that's in need of very serious attention. And can you also, maybe in writing afterwards, you're unlikely to have the detail here, but give more detail on those three loans, two from the Development Bank, one from the RMB. Thank you for the information you have given on the pay risk. I do know about that. So if you could just give more detail on what they were for, how much is still owed on each, I think that would help us to get clarity on the economic standing of the university.
Thank you, Professor.
The next one is Honorable Member Fatah. I'll share my last comment with you on the American school. I think the work we've done
over the years, I think it must be contrasted the amount of land that are in the system and how sustainable they are in our biggest system. I think you are one of the first mistakes that can be avoided. The answers from all private tax areas than the usual. And I think that that significantly through the courage of the person that you accepted and what they saw in the profession than what you have ordinarily happened, if they open up too much. That's the comment. So for me, really, the rural rocks in that sense. Rural rocks. And then the last one, I just want to clear something, because I happen to understand the certain sequence of how these loans work. I just want to have an acknowledgement if either of those loans were ministerial, because you know that there has to be a threshold that council must approve, but the minister must also be approved. Were both of them approved, and if they were, then we must be able.
Yes, they were approved, and we also conform to the interest of the European Union with comes to the rules.
I'm telling you, the establishment is passionate about fighting and
thank you, Chair Bertram. The first point from your responses, the particular issue of enrollment, the university is actually increasing on the college graduates. It is quite commendable, of course, which means that they could save and is taken away from the teaching university into the faculty. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And,
the turnover of staff post major was a result, and it opened doors for the university to get young and young professors. Can the secretary associate on this by giving us figures in terms of gender? Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Honourable Member Ketan.
Thanks, Chair. I'm just taking advantage of that view from the academic institution right here. Maybe you can throw light on this question that I'm going to ask. I know that is not necessarily a mining province, but I heard from SAFM, the Maxim Mining General, quarter to eight, that mining, a lot of mining injuries, a lot of youngsters who graduate in mining engineering are unemployed. And my school actually suggested that they should go into research, into agriculture, because mining and all the mining material that get thrown over land, especially agricultural land, they could do something to expand those and make land available, go to agriculture, which is an open area. It is just worrying because we told mining, I mean engineering is a scarce field, that is where jobs are. And when you hear on the radio FM that mining engineers, especially ladies, they are here, a lot of young ladies are moving in, graduate, but they are unemployed, you get worried. My question, because you do have agricultural mining, agricultural engineering, sorry, do you have an idea what's happening there and how we can rescue the situation? We can have a situation where we can create jobs in this area. Why do you think you're moving in that area? No, this area, there's no job creation. Yeah. I'm a bit frustrated.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And also,
I
think
thank you, Chairperson. I just want to make a general comment that perhaps references what Honourable Bozzoli spoke about which is the price of transformation in higher education. And I think it doesn't just affect UKZN, it affects several other institutions in South Africa. So this is what calls the Forum of University Chairpersons, where we meet on a regular basis, perhaps a couple of times a year, to discuss generic issues in the higher education system. We recently had a meeting as the executive of Chairperson in South Africa. We recently had a meeting with ESA, and we really discussed this matter, which is that any university that genuinely embraces the transformation mandate of South Africa pays a price for it. The university pays a price for it because if you look at the funding system of the university, if you look at the funding formula and the way that it is structured, there is no real benefit to a university that embraces kids from Ubuntu, that embraces kids from Tata, that embraces kids from Sabina. There is no benefit to things within the currency. And therefore, those institutions that decide to attempt to, in a difficult environment, balance their books, pay the price. The price they pay is that Minister Zimande, at a meeting that we had with the chairperson, said that every year it's like the bold and the beautiful I'm quoting. There are certain institutions that have strikes. There are certain institutions that are known that will have strikes, and those are around the deposit, because the deposit is generally very high, and there is always a cohort of students, maybe 200 or 300, as the financial and chief financial officer said, who have passed all their modules, who can't get into university. There is nothing more painful than the letters that we receive as council members. Those students who have passed exceptionally well and still can't continue because they can't afford it. Therefore, in embracing the transformation mandate of Africa, the economy of the university takes a strain. The universities that we are talking about are universities that carry a large version of historical student debt. Some of the student debt that we are talking about is actually pre-merger student debt that we are still managing today. A university such as UKZN, actually embraced the merger. We did not oppose it, that was government, we embraced the merger. And in embracing the merger, if you look at the little post retirement medical aid liability, that is actually pre-merger. Quite a significant portion of it. What it did was that at merger, the first thing that we did to mitigate that risk was to actually change the conditions of employment, make sure that any further employees that we put into UK then do not have those benefits. So within your institution, you now have set of employees who've got differentiated conditions of employment. That further, in our environment that you got four, that further makes your working environment very difficult because you've got different sets of employees who've actually got different types of benefit and they're all looking for UKZN. Those are the difficult and real challenges that we have to deal with as UKZN, whilst wanting to be globally relevant, participating in global rankings voluntarily, because we want to remain globally relevant. So in as much as we embrace South Africa's transition mandate, we also want to be a global university that's relevant. And I do think that, and it's not just UKZN, it's several other universities. I was recently at a Cape Town university that I would have mentioned. I was putting a family member for admission. The financial aid office was empty. At UKZN, at the beginning of the year, the financial aid office had got students go out again. At this particular university, there was nobody at the financial aid office. The government funds most universities significantly. So my comment is that, and I'm sorry to know, Chairperson, but I feel really strongly about this point, that the economy of the university and the funding model of the university, and I know that this is something that most parts of the world
I'm just going to quickly wrap up, Chair, with a few points. I can just confirm for the majority that we are taking the issue of economy and university very seriously. We understand in terms of balancing the business and taking us forward. We have to improve that situation and we're going to take it. But the problem with eating elephants is if you have to go slowly and start at one end and carry on, you know, you're not going to do it all in one go. And I think that's what we face to do. I'm glad to hear that one of the members thinks that you're a rock star. I use that myself. But I think please watch this space because our distributed training model we're putting in place for medical training into the future can actually make the impact of working even better. So I think we really got some nice innovative work we're doing in that area. And then I just want to say that the postgraduate teaching business research, we are a research-led university. This is one of our mission statements. We are going to be a research-led university. But we still have 25% of our students are postgraduate, 75% of them are undergraduates. So we train at the moment 44,000 students. of which at least 30 or 35,000 of them are individuals. So we make a significant contribution to training as well. I think that every university needs to do both. The question of what's the right balance to make sure that you achieve your research objectives, but have enough material to work with, because that's what comes out of the training to actually support your research efforts in the future. So that's what we're looking to do. The staff, so no, we don't have any fears, but we can send that through to you if you want to get a sense of what's happened there in that regard. And then the mining engineering, I'm afraid so, I don't have very good news for you. The problem with engineering in the area of resource extraction around the world is the resource prices are dropping, the jobs are dropping around the world, and there are very few economies where the positions in areas like mining engineering actually grow. Australia is one of the few places in the world where the number of jobs actually are growing in that area. But engineers are always useful, and they need to be deployed and trained in those areas. And I think that's sometimes one of the mistakes we make when we train people. I always say to people, we have to train, we have to train people who are working in this economy 20 years into the future. And that means that at that time, 20% of the jobs currently exist no longer exist. And it also means that at that time, 20% new jobs we haven't even thought about this in the sense of the game. That's how our economy evolves. So we have to train people to be looking at the economy over the horizon and not what's going on around in the immediate environments around. Otherwise, we're missing the opportunity to place people in the market. And that's one of the things we're going to discuss today. So are we training people for the future, not just for the business?
Two of the questions. Maybe just following up from what the VC has said, what we can do is that we do track the employment of our graduates, and according to our graduate surveys at the moment, it shows that quite consistently 84-85% of graduates get employed within 6 months of graduating. So we do have very high rates also. We are trying to follow up more closely on that, to differentiate between different degree qualifications. But just to make that comment. And then just to respond, we do anticipate that given the news and media focus on African professors, that you would ask such a question. So we do have the figures, and I'm happy to share them, to say that at the moment we have 11 African full professors, 7 male and 4 female. If you take the professoriate as a whole, that means both full and associate professors, we have 14 African professors and 11 females, so about 25, and that's about 10% of the professoriate as a whole. We're also very much keen on following the gender, both race and gender, and so in terms of gender, we have 59 black women professors, and we have 54 professors. So overall, it's just one of the overall figures. At the moment, our white professors constitute 41% of the professoriate, 38% is black, and 10% is African.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All the questions from the one on the headline.
I would just like to again thank all the honourable members for and the chair for the opportunity to come and talk to the parliament about what's happening at UKZN, and we're happy to do so again in the future. We will send some of the missing information that we said we would share with the members, and we look forward to working with this committee into the future to make sure that UKZN really achieves what it set out to do, but at the same time make sure that it's an institution that contributes towards our national objectives in the best possible manner. So, yeah, I think we're
that you were just to see.
Thank you. I will now
talk to
one of the people.
Well, thank you very much, Chair. One of the chairs and one of the members, Chair of the management. No, Chair, thank you very much, Chair. As a question for all of the ladies. First and foremost, let me thank the portfolio committee for really pushing this matter at a very high level. It's a very important matter that should be discussed, especially in this matter. And I must say, Chair, you recall that the white paper play really set the scene on how our institutions are in issue. And since then, there have been, you know, strides, gains in that on the side of the department. The head of the department, we are currently implementing the first thing to try it. You know, Chair, that we have started implementing some of the recommendations of the report of the association. In that, we appointed the Ministerial Consent Committee on Transformation Led by Mr. Mahoma. And we are looking now at establishing a third unit within the department to actually assist us. Also, the very framework on starting South Africa's universities is not only looking at revitalizing the academic profession, but transforming the academic profession. We've had a number of stakeholders serving this chair, convened by the department, calling on all stakeholders to one group to discuss this matter, how we once and for all transform our institutions so that they are reflective of the democratic system of our country. He is on all sides and attempts from the side of government, but he also requires individual institutions to take the issue. It requires all of us to actually make a contribution in this regard. But I do, Chair, want to speak to two issues that relate to this discussion. And something that was raised by also. I had the pleasure of attending the installation of Dr. Charles Burns at Natan as a vice chancellor. And indeed, I find it quite odd that honorable man. Could really, you know, put all the successes to the university without really recognizing that leadership of the university and all these things that the contributors and the university who is not an AA course. Just like I think Dr. Aspens has filled the shoes of the great chance of the leader who allowed the university, you know, during the very hostile period of the merger. He has the possibly consolidated because it's one of the very few universities that actually managed it very well. And when you take, for instance, the university, I mean, the Devon University, when you see certain performance there, it has improved significantly. And we can only attribute all these things to Professor Mahoma for his institution leadership and course to counsel. So I think it's unfortunate that. But of course, when we talk transformation, obviously, to be part of that is very important process. Actually, also, I think the process of redress definitely going to help universities in a way, economically viable. And that's just the thing for reality. Of course, it's universities that are willing to take this project that would actually be active participants in the research process. So, it's very much university for us. The chair makes it, for example, of those are universities that do not want to take things that you want to make economically viable and so forth and so forth. But I think, actually, when you talk transformation, it is not even to actually hold a college of institutions. So when you have a whole institution, so it's used to be so. But, Honorable Bas, should be looking at both the two projects participation.
responded right. Remember, we are now closing. So if there are other questions, transformation of the staff. That's why it is it is the compliance issue. So there outstation has to be performed. We have to balance it with compliance. So we expect it to comply. Remember, it's got to be by company. Anything that is a strategy, tell them the same story. So that we take the information to the United. Tell them that you don't compromise on the guidance, which is the law. What are the options? So then it's described to the organization in the test to them. So each region has to have control over it. I like other ones. Because it also depends on the money and blah, 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 blah. But this one, as we push, we then look at what the FIT can have also. Thank you very much for that one. We really would like to commend you on the good progress in the educational access of the South African students, in the sense of giving those from the previous disadvantaged backgrounds. We'd like to commend you on this one. Of course, Honorable Member Malta has all questions and bad for the leaders on sensitivity on your increase of sensitivity. So that the admission or the increased access is not stuck with that. It is this that can stuck with that. So the more you increase, and you must read correctly, that you don't want to close people out. So that's why there was a request, but I thought everything that you have done in benchmark, did I call it correctly? But still, I know that we've also requested no, we haven't requested that. It is out of minister's initiative. But also, in terms of Mr. Lacan's input, also take care of the individual in terms of the responsibility. Like, all people must access, and all young people should access. It means this area of the responsibility. So as you increase the people, you can have the change. So one more interesting from your presentation is the college for innovation in funding the 8,000 students out of the 15,000 students that were supposed to be funded by ESPA. I'm sure it comes from your reserves. It also comes from the budget allocation. Remember, you have control there. You want to see and allocate your budget. And also your priorities. They must be right. Now here we see you and it's a very correct attitude the vice chancellor, prioritize the students. We are about the students, we are the teacher leaders. And unless we are capable of an educated nation, we will not be able to move from a developing a developing stage to a developing. Your liability on the post-retirement medical aid to the value of 1.2 billion is our concern. I'm sure the council will find an amicable way of managing this challenge. But also in touch with you, we also have a problem. We also have a problem. Now, what do you do when you identify a gap in the way of solving that? So we want to rely on yourself and the people who have changed. To check from their results and then to assist us to find a solution. It cannot be there forever to find a solution. And then on the, of course, transformation, where we spoke about the transformation being costly, I cannot agree more with you, Chair. Indeed, the transformation from the dark past to the very but sooner we complete this cycle, the better can focus on the real issues. For now, it is a priority, but we must finish. This transformation will be there forever and ever. I said to you, but it's 1994, up to date, not now. So sooner we must check and look, there will be the spirit of grand coming. For now, and you gave a very good illustration. From the investors of the receipt from the other university, and if you merge the two, you are bound to harmonize. You are so bound to harmonize. Otherwise, you will still be the integrity of the constitution for advanced discrimination. So you found, so achieve the constitutional thing. So I think it will be, I'm happy that it will be. But for now, opposition are there. You still have to get to your assistant in your salary system. So even on this one, it's a close system. It's a close system. So we can focus on other things. Harmonize, once finished, shouldn't take you long. And then, I know it's going to be costly, but it's fine. As long as you can land the transformation and other people will feel. Right, and then he talks to the position of the payment. It is an area. He talks about transformation indicators. This one, I'm talking about this part of this one, I promise you, don't be money. So the Well, on the Department of Higher Education and Training Infrastructure Grant, we believe that you have the infrastructure development plan. But soon we have the year of the month, but it's not linked to the plan. Because once we release your plan, we will be really short that this plan is going to be implemented on another basis. So your plan will be your MTF plan. Then on an annual basis, you spoke about grade 200 million as heavily expended. Well, our interest then on your 200 million capital expenditure per year is fast tracking and deliver within the given time frame because the plan will be time bound so that you can absorb your new enrollment in the new year. This has been a problem. I'm sure you. So that if you come new year, our problem, our issue will not be application. It will be enough for 2 months. For continuity in the implementation of the working also, on your capital expenditure, our greatest interest is on positive impact. On the candle control deficit, which increased from 363 million in 2013 to 430 million in 2014. Chair, the wet deficit is a negative and subject to misinterpretation. Unfortunately, you also spoke about it. So I think that I'm going to use your wisdom to hear me clearly. So, the council as an accounting authority to the government, I must say that this is an accident. You need to teach, like you said, to get the evidence. And actually, it's taking the truth. Instead of looking at the reason why the court was very wise about this is because it entered us. So I think this is one area that is acceptable and check and give you our recommendation that we're going to find a corrective measure. That's our recommendation. On the debt, you know, Professor has already raised this one. The debt, and he really clearly defined what is the debt as an institution. Then, the CFO, you know that you're expected to come up with a debt management strategy. And from our side, we will please reduce. And we please reduce until you learn to clear the path. Because whether we want or not, with this debt, we will then have a major interest. Which, in the top of your CFMA, okay, but AG would then define this as fruitless expenditure. Yes? As a service, the interest, fruitless expenditure. Money that you could keep in, you know, on your network, augmentally, network. But for now, you go to service with your end of interest. So, I think you must try to find a way of sharing this debt. Now to the institution, you recommend that you create a consistent environment for the council to stay until the end of the action. Because the one of them is going to be
policy. National certificate vocational in about 1-9 months, so that students know that they can complete it.
In principle, it's fine. The issue is about the competition situation. There's applications from the university that have been published, and we have 100,000 applications.
No, that's fine. Use the information, you will know what works for you.
But
in principle, you know that
in principle,
the other needs, area of needs, that's why we are talking to you about it. But do what you need, and then there is the other needs. And you know, where, what is the need that's related to your shopping? And then also the issue of student debt in this I'm concluding. Also in appealing to the university to support appealing for support by the university to ensure that student college lecturers are capacitated. Or it is a support by the university to learn to commend you and appreciate that support. The issue of unlocking entrepreneurial possibilities is highly commendable. Of course, the university to partner with historically disadvantaged universities in research, innovation, and academic support. Of course, we are doing well in this opportunity. Then, if you want to say social, I'm not sure if social is not a big way to get back. All right? We, of course, have not yet the challenge of dispensing the issues of community and faith. Otherwise, I think the mission of this community is very much for the engagement, because the community is a mission. The community is responsible for our mission. The community is sure of the reaching between ourselves.
Well,
So that we save time, which we don't have, because I was doing so, maybe I could just give you more response to your question, how we prepare. We've looked at in terms of our requirements, we've looked at white paper, on translation as an institution. And also we look at the recommendations of the Sujin Committee that was focusing on transformation of the institution. So the recommendation will still serve the purpose, from my understanding, of the decided strategy. Now, the other thing is that it's quite a long presentation, and we deliberately did it in that way, because it can then still be used for preparation for the visit, but we will not present the whole presentation yet, because that's quite lengthy. I understand that you received the copies also of this. The minor revisions that you did were just in relation to grammar and typo. So the version that we are presenting here has got those slight changes in terms of grammar and typos, which we will be able to talk to. Now, the white paper 3 that we're referring to here, we was adopted in 1997, the title being a framework for transformation of higher education. It seeks to guide programs and processes in the transforming the social public education system with a vision of a transformed, democratic, non-racial, non-sexist system of higher education that will support a democratic ethos and a culture of human rights
high educational progress and success is conducive to precise positive thinking, cultural tolerance, and a common commitment to humane, non-resistant, and non-threatening social contact. That's a statement by which all the institutions should be going on at doing their business of teaching learning methods at the institutions in the environment conducive to their students. And the changes that they have to be making in the process, all guided by that statement from the White Paper. Now, we also listed in the presentation the goals of the White Paper, again, which are guiding this in this case. In their policies as well, you know, guiding them in their policies, guiding them in their structures, and guiding them in their operations. Now, that would include, for instance, the enrollment, that would include the staff composition, once we get transformation in that sense. And then again, and we also looked at the student report, what the student report recommended. Fortunately, the recommendations from that report were directed. There were recommendations directed at the Department of Education and Training, particularly the Minister, and there were recommendations directed at the institutions, and what the institutions are supposed to be doing in order to advance transformation. And also, in the investigation, as much as some of the recommendations may not be specific to particular institutions, but in the investigation, they were able to group some institutions, for instance, with the former accounts, universities, historically disadvantaged institutions, former white liberal institutions, that is the language that they use. So they were able to say this is what we find or we found at those institutions. And in as a question for this presentation, we also went back into those investigations in terms of the categories of those institutions. Now, what the student report found, and this is not too long ago, 2008, that the state of transformation is painfully slow in higher education, and racism is endemic within institutions. That there was little or no internal dialogue between institutional constituencies on issues of transformation and the institutional forums which should be facilitating such dialogue providers. And most institutions adopt a compliance approach which focuses on numerical targets or change in racial demography, which is not a true measure of success or transformation. And that is the same we still observe even today, that, you know, if the numbers have changed, therefore we have changed, we have transformed. Numbers on gender, numbers on race, if we have got more than we had in the past, or the tables have changed in a way, then we have transformed. So that is what we still observe at the conclusion. And we also observe that while institutions have made a remarkable progress in achieving regulatory compliance and a range of policies in place to address issues of transformation, concerns remain policy implementation and the question of transforming the institutional culture. And that is the most difficult one, and that is the most the most important that the institution has to be transforming, that is the institutional culture. So that institutions have got a culture that is welcoming to everyone, people who are not necessarily associated with the culture of the institution before, so that when they arrive at the institution, they don't feel less than. And the focus areas, recommended by Sudin report, with the staff experience, language, student living, and governance. At the institution, including governance at the student residence. And what the students also said was that in terms of staff experience, the reasons for failure to retain black and women staff was associated with institutional culture, hence discrimination faced by black academics, rather than the higher salaries of foreign public and the private sector. So that still alludes to the importance of looking after the institutional culture, so that we have a culture that is welcoming to everyone. the committee also noted that the cultural silence that permeated the institution because of fear of victimization. And people didn't want to talk on issues that relate to transformation because of fear of that victimization. And while institutions have put initiatives in place to address issues of self-efficacy, transformation and discrimination, the real-life experiences of staff members suggested that racism remained a problem in many institutions. And that entry of new web staff was seen to be impeded by the absence of the effective mechanisms for monitoring appointment processes. And many institutions, despite having intensive transformation policies, seem to struggle to build a sense of social cohesion in which all staff members feel equally valued. And then, of course, it goes on the issue of language. And, of course, we're taking from the Constitution in a five language issues and what the institutions are doing. But generally, pointing to the fact that the institutions were still not doing enough in terms of promoting language and also making the language policies of institutions such that the institutions that were welcoming language policies. And again, on student living, something that keeps popping up, especially at the former Afghans campuses, as we have had in the past recent years, for example, that's popped up at Suzhou University, at the Kwasiatong campus of Northwest University, at Stellenbosch University, and by recent past, you know, referring to the past at least past 3 years, up to this last year. And just to remind you also, honorable members, that the Sudin report itself, the Sudin committee itself was appointed on the basis of what caught up at the University of Free State, there is also. Now, again, I won't go in detail on the student living, but these are some of the issues that Dr. pointed out. That all historical white institutions were committed to integration of residents, but something was the strides were not enough. The strides that the institution had made at the time, but we can also confirm that even now the strides that the institutions have made are still not enough. And that the most important and most concerning thing is that of alumni seem to play an important role in maintaining the identity, culture, and tradition of residents. And you would understand that the alumni of some of the institutions are people, you know, alumni being the graduates of an institution, are people who had themselves gone through the institutions while they were under apartheid. And the segregation was put the order of the day at the time, and therefore we still have the alumni that has got upper hand on how residences are run, then become the concern. And this is what we've seen for me to found at the institution. And then in terms of governance, in some council policies that may be unpopular were approved in order to comply with legislative and regulatory requirements, but with the full knowledge that effective little attempt would be made to implement the policies also ensure their success. And again, alumni playing a role there, making their presence felt at some of the institutions. And that in some institutions, Black Council members who raise issues of relation to transformation were marginalized or even voted out of office. We haven't, in the recent years, seen that practice necessarily, but it does not necessarily mean that it's no longer happening. But there has been no report that the council is about that points to that direction. And then in terms of recommendations, if I may just quickly go through them, the recommendations of the Sudan committee, and these are the recommendations that institutions would have been expected to follow and still following currently, or some of them have taken. Institutions to take up the challenge of finding additional sources of funding to support and middle staff members upon their entry into academia. Now, this is also what the department is assisting institutions to do, as individually as well as now the South Africa University framework. The vice chancellors of the institutions to be held directly accountable for the achievement of the employment equity target. Council should take direct responsibility for monitoring employment equity by establishing an employment equity subcommittee chaired by an external member of council. We have yet to come across a council that has got that subcommittee. So we don't think that the institution has needed that advice or that recommendation from the institution. The factual racial segregation and discrimination that results in readily defined demarcation, the abolished in favor of placement policies that create opportunities for students from different backgrounds to live together. And that is what we also understood that institutions are doing. But these unfortunately embarrass institutions when there's an incident that comes out from the institution. And this was the case recently at the Kosher Two Numbers of the University of Northern. Processes to be put in place to ensure that residence committees are been demographically representative, organizational and government structural basis to be used to ensure that power and authority that senior states have over junior periods are removed and carried. Student orientation programs should be reviewed to ensure their appropriateness in terms of addressing issues of inclusivity and diversity while preserving the dignity of students. That talks to the issue of human rights. And all initiation ceremonies and activities should be banned. That also was a recommendation from this department, not only from the student committee, but also from this department. Institutional councils should develop a clear transformation framework, including transformation indicator, accompanied by targets, which should form the basis of the district's governance concept. And in view of the absence of a general transformation plan in the majority of institutions, it's rather recommended that institutions develop transformation charter for themselves, and you would have seen that in the presentation from the investor class in Natal. And the freedom and right of students to organize along political lines to reinstate an institution where the freedom is taken away. And that each institution by council establishes an office of the ombudsman. And the ombudsman would need to be independent of the institution and would receive and deal with all complaints relating to discrimination within that particular institution. There are about 8 institutions currently that have got the ombudsman office, and some about 4 others that would have those services embedded elsewhere at the institution's management. We did encourage institutions at any rate to establish the offices because the department now is having to deal on a daily basis with a lot of complaints from the institutions, and that capacity we do not have from this department. We have also put this on the table of the transmission oversight policy so that they could also take up the matter of dealing with the complaints from the institution. Now, I will just look...
Questions
say as well also that if there is any other information that relates to the Western institution, particularly the Northern Cross Institute, I think for our own, not necessarily for any type of specific have to be aware of the things that university and student colleges have been doing, the activities. Well, those are the things that in order to appreciate the entire environment of the higher education institution rather than always coming in as a police. I don't think we are police people. I think we are a citizen organization, and I think we have to also encourage and know the diversity that people do.
In terms of the transformation of the department, the reports of that committee and information that is relevant to us as our work that can be made available to the public. No, but beyond what is, like I said, from the transformation piece of the department, the reports from that committee, or is there any annual reports, or is there anything work that has been done that can, that information can be made
and the reports. Maybe we'll take it from the reports.
Obviously can use the principle of this question and answer each other. If they
has been available. But further to say, the two other, which I would presume is a policy, would be the white paper, one on the digital transformation, the white paper 3, 1997, and the white paper on post-education. Those two can be used as a yardstick to create a policy by the community to engage the institutions around issues of transformation. So it should be the two, the white paper 3 and the white paper post-education and training, and the skill report, and of course, those that would be made available by the university education branch. And so far as the work that is being undertaken by the OSEC, but there is no formal report really at this point. Alluded to briefings, which has to be separate from the presentation that can be compiled by the university education branch of the department. If that can also be requested from the matter committee so that we have everything available, we don't waste our time when we go there.
Explain how the presentation was made, which we probably answered, and also to the document that we're going to send. So we first outlined the goals that were set in the white paper 6, and the ones that speak directly to the institutions and the things that they were supposed to work towards. Then we then looked at the supreme report, which was the study that was done based on the issues of transformation, of the lack of transformation, and looked at the recommendations, because those are some of the things that can be used to check how far the institutions have gone in implementing some of those recommendations. And then the presentation then looked at the institutional plans that are associated with transformation, but as well as highlight maybe some of the challenges in the institutions that are in line with the transformation goals. So what we can also make available is the strategic plan which outlines the transformation goals of the institution, because those can be used as well to engage with the progress or whatever. So with Stellenbosch University, we're able to get the 2016 to 2020, I think, yeah, the future plan, but also to show the current status, if I may say. But for UCT, for example, I think they still have the 2010, those are the documents that we have access to that we use to present the presentation. So, but like the statistics in terms of sample size and all of that, we had show the same kind of demographics.
and helpful when I was making my closer comments on the presentation of the personal question that was happening. I think to say, so we really approach the comments, and so that's the feeling of the success, that's the meaning of the satisfaction of taking this particular message. Of course, the UK is is one of the universities that, as you correctly alluded earlier, that are active for N. In fact, as I recall the meeting where the oversight committee presented, I think they presented some equities in the council. Thank you very much again. We will make the information available that we can then to checklist the also get to the committee, the oversight committee check by on where they are. We are expecting report. As I said, Chair, after we appointed that oversight committee, it was clear that they did not have much capacity. That is why we are now establishing a committee to do actually support the oversight committee, because Professor, as you know, was still the vice chancellor of the UNSFN, and other members of the committee were also doing many other things. So we thought they on their own cannot be able to really dedicate much of their time to the work of the committee. So let's establish a unit that will support them from a secretariat point of view.
doing our head in the CA in the assembly. And then the leadership of Stellenbosch is replaced by the Ministry of Strategy. Otherwise, the program stayed on the logistics, I think that was communicated to us on time. And also, I thought I should also inform members that, inform members of the passing away of Kenny, age to honorable member Kekazen, father to pass on. Pass on.
When we're doing the program that ends today, we suggested that the name in the form of just requesting an amendment.
Okay.
And then we were advised that we always try and do that before the program is finalized.
Okay. I think the only issue is that yesterday, on the transmission page, I think thank you very much for your hard work. This committee is very important. And I'm happy with the quality input that you get from committee members. It shows that you really take the work seriously and you care about the community. And you can see the people that we engage with, they also have the interest in our experience by showing seriousness and also engaging meaningfully.